This is a radio production of the Direct Action Media Network. It's Sunday, April 19th, 1998. We're sitting here with Jesse Hirsch from Toronto. Jesse, just give us a brief overview of what you're going to be talking about, because we're going to tape your whole presentation.
Well, it'll first depend on what people are interested in hearing about, but I think I'm going to talk about the changing nature of the state and the tactics necessary to counter this change, explicitly looking at the relationship between artificial intelligence and virtual reality as the state, and then the role of hacking reality and the role that community-based participatory democracy can play in usurping the changing nature of the state and smashing it in its metamorphosis, so to speak. As the state changes, it becomes vulnerable, and this is the opportunity then to strike.
But I thought the title of your talk was Revolution and Counter-Revolution on the Internet.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Oh. Well, you didn't mention
you
didn't mention the Internet at this.
Well, the Internet, the first thing I'll do is I'll dispense with the myth of the Internet.
Which is what?
Which is that the Internet exists. And then so when we'll get to that. We'll wait to the thing. I wanted to go. I just missed the lineup for breakfast. Okay, but let's get back to the point here. The Internet Revolution, that's what IBM calls it. Right? And the Counter Revolution, who's that? So we're getting to this realm of doublespeak and paradox, so I thought the first thing to do is get out of that. Okay. And start looking at reality, what's happening, what's going on. Okay. So I'm going to talk about, I'm going to use McLuhan's concept of the rearview mirror to talk about how our culture moves so fast that it's difficult to really tell where we are. Because what happens is what we see is the present is really the past, right? Because we move so slow, and I want to get out of that, and I want to talk about what's really happening in the present. So I start by saying, let's look at the state. Okay. What is the state happening right now, and how do we have to respond to it? Okay. Or even at a much lower level, where does self-defense come in? Where do we have to defend ourselves from the state? Because it is waging a constant assault against us. Is that right?
Okay, thank you, Jesse. We'll look forward to your talk.
Woo-hoo.
Now you can go stand in line for breakfast.
Brian asked me in putting together the program for this morning to speak about the Internet. Before I address that, I mean, I basically have, let's say, 20 minutes of material prepared that I can give, although I'd much prefer to run this as a workshop, where people either A, ask questions of the group, B, share anecdotes, whether success stories or failures in terms of how they engage media in general, or see whatever random rant comes up after some of the material that I'll present. Just a brief background on where the ideas I'm presenting come from. I'm part of a collective which is based in Toronto, which is called DAO, which is an acronym for the Anarchy Organization. We're basically anarchists who are into various forms of organizing. But explicitly what we are is organized labor. And we organize a labor pool of various types of, I mean, generally at this point it's our group of peers or our circle of friends, but over time this will increase to accommodate other people who aren't even necessarily anarchists, but who believe in basic elements of anti-authoritarian democratic struggle, but need to pay rent and need to support themselves. One of the main facets of DAO is that we've taken a computer, a Pentium computer, and I've installed Linux, which is a free operating system on it. By installing Linux and then connecting it to international data networks, the server, which the Unix server, basically provides three primary functions. The first is as an international communications facility, in that it enables communications across different nations. One of them is the NEZN list that some of you in the room are on. The other thing that it does is it's a hypertextual multimedia archive, in the sense that it's able to store text, video, audio, various types of information, and hypertext, in the sense that it can be interlinked in various different ways. And the other function that the server plays is as an autonomous manager of space and time, in that it allows people to communicate over space and through time at their convenience. Now, I'm using very explicit and general terms to describe this Unix server, because what generally happens is, because of this Unix server, people assume that DAO is an internet group, when in fact, I mean, this is yet to be agreed upon by consensus, but I think that almost all people within DAO are actually against computers, and we actually would like to see computers permanently removed, and we're also, again, I would like to see the internet smashed. Now, I would just like to say this to clarify, because most people do perceive DAO as an internet group, whereas in fact what we're doing is we're trying to deal with the internet, because it is such a prevalent fixture in the public mind right now, and we feel that if we don't actually address it and deal with it, we'll be sorry later. But I should state again, before going into the prepared remarks, we provide all services for free. The idea is that we're squatting space within the networks. Networks have traditionally existed as communications for various aspects of society. Some of the more famous are old boys networks, which of course are the fabric of the state. Most of you are participants in grassroots networks, which are different types of social movements. The idea that we like to do is have networks for people, and these types of networks require communications, whether it be radio, whether it be email, whether it be telephone, whether it be various other types of network communications. And we provide these services for free. One of the groups we provide for free is the Syracuse Media Action Group. I'm in actually disagreement with them when they call it a virtual server, in the sense that I don't think it's virtual at all. I see the server all the time, and I know it's very physical. And what we do in the community, in terms of the Community Media Action Group, is we recognize squatters' rights. They're basically using the server for free, and because we happen to be anti-authoritarian and believe in various other principles, we grant them squatters' rights. We say you can govern your own use on this server, even though you don't actually have the server in your physical presence. And so I extend that to anyone else in the room. The address is tao.ca. If you're interested in getting access to this server, you can email new@tao.ca, and we'll help you out to the best that we can. Although I should stress that we are pretty much against computers and against the internet, so we won't necessarily be as responsive as CompuServe or America Online. Now, you might have noticed that in my prefatory remarks, I have yet to really use the word internet. I've used Linux server, I've used communications, and for me, I mean, the two main questions that I deal with in my research that I do is, what is the internet and what is convergence? Which, from my analysis, those two questions are pressing questions that everyone, left and right, corporate and public, seem to be addressing. And at this point in time, and I'm not sure of these answers, when I ask myself, what is the internet, I say, quite frankly, it does not exist. It is a complete figment of our imagination. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm sure most of us have used email. And email exists. And many of us have seen the web. And the World Wide Web, that exists. But the internet, this does not. I personally haven't seen it, I haven't tasted it, I haven't touched it, I haven't smelt it. As far as I know, it does not exist. Now, unfortunately, there happens to be a large amount of money invested in corporate propaganda to tell us all that the internet exists. So if it does exist, and this is me sort of flipping on the other side and saying, okay, well, maybe I will admit the internet exists, then it's everything. Completely, holistically, everything. There is no way that you can say the internet is not something if you're going to say it exists. And so when I say everything, I include MTV, I include the phone system, I include postal mail, I include verbal communication, I include thoughts that you have while you're asleep. You know, this is all the internet. Right? It's a metaphor being used to how we communicate, but it's not even talking about explicit or conscious communication, it's talking about connections. And the types of connections it's talking about range from everything between making a connection between, I don't know, Freeport MacMoran and East Timor, or Nestle and Chiapas, or different neurons in your brain. These are all parts of the internet. And again, I don't really want to go that far, so I just say the internet doesn't exist. And metaphorically, what it represents is the unknown. Which, of course, doesn't exist because we don't know about it. We can only know what exists. But again, I don't want to get too philosophical there. The other question is, what is convergence? because convergence increasingly is being used to justify, on the one hand, corporate policy in terms of, you know, everything from corporate concentration of media to bank mergers to, you know, liberalization of free trade. All of this is the whole idea that we're all coming into a global village. Globalization is this inevitable process of interdependence, where everything sort of connects with each other and it's all part of this one world. And again, I say, well, where does this convergence word come from? So when I looked in, you know, sort of did some research on the word, I found that it's very much a religious construct. In Western society, convergence has to do with what, you know, mythologically has been termed the Holy Grail. You know, which was this whole mythical construct saying this is where Christ, you know, the last blood of Christ was caught, and it's this holy artifact that is Christ embodied on earth, and if you get to be with the Holy Grail, then you're immortal. And of course, as someone who is raised an atheist, I say, wait a minute. Why is this convergence thing also related to this corporate policy? Oh yeah. And without going further into that, there's this guy, David Noble, came out with this book, The Religion of Technology, which shows the millenarian aspects of essentially corporate technology, how it's very much a religious project. Right, the idea that you can sort of take all of the, and again, you know, I'm using another person's framework. Yeah, you want to ask? Millenarian refers to a strain of fundamental Christianity that basically arises, has historically arises around the turn of millenniums, that deals with everything like apocalypse, the second coming of Christ, you know, the book of Revelations misinterpreted in terms of, you know, fundamentalism. It's basically fascism in a very religious constructed form. And what I found is convergence is very much part of this culture. That convergence, and to link this into what I was saying, that the internet is the unknown, convergence is faith in the unknown. Convergence is the belief that when globalization is inevitable and it will come and it will give us this utopian world where everything will be okay. Certainly this is what the capitalists are trying to sell us in the internet. Saying the internet will provide community, the internet will provide democracy, the internet will provide blah, 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 blah. You know, and there's all these different myths that are embedded into the ads of IBM, that are embedded to the ads of America Online, that are embedded into all these different things, but more importantly, they're embedded into the corporate policy that is driving mergers and acquisition. Right, that is driving what's initially within sectors, within banks merging and telephones merging, but in the next 3 years will be banks buying telephone companies, buying electric companies. And you'll see increasingly what convergence will mean is cross-sectoral, so it'll just be corporate blocks that basically deliver all the different services you can. So, I mean, I've glossed over internet and convergence, and I could spend time going on them, but I'm not, because I'd like to get to the main reason, the main concern that a lot of us have, and that's the state. And that's the raging nature of the state. And, right now I'm 23. When I was a teenager and going through high school and just entering university, I was always really frustrated in Canada with how, you know, the liberal establishment viewed the state and what they called the state. Because personally, I never saw that as a state. I didn't see that the Prime Minister of Canada or the President of the United States had power, in so much of had independent power. Rather, I saw another authority that, in fact, that was governing society. So I looked at governance and I said, how is society governed? Now, a quick aside to give a theoretical preface. I rip off a lot of the ideas of Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan was a thief who was based at the University of Toronto, who appropriated ideas from various different types of theorists, dating back from the turn of the century with theorists like Teilhard de Chardin up to around the 1950s with a political economist named Harold Innes. What Marshall McLuhan did is he appropriated all these ideas and popularized them in aphorisms like the medium is the message or the global village. But in reality, Marshall McLuhan didn't really do anything new, and neither am I in taking one of his metaphors, which was the rearview mirror, in which he described this context of culture moving so quickly that we can't really keep up with what exists, and that what we see as the present is really what's past. You know, and two classic examples, one of them is that we live in the information age, when in fact the information age is over. Right, the information age was the Cold War. It was about television, it was about telephones, it was about bureaucracy, it was about paper pushing. It was about people moving around information within the society, and the society being based on that movement of information. We've gone past that. But because we've gone past that, you find that that's now what everyone's saying we're in. Right, because they're just coming to grips with the decades that we've gone past, and we're lost in this time warp, if you will. You know, another example of where of the past is saying that this is a digital age, or that everything now is digital. Again, this is not true. The digital age has passed. The digital age, again, was the Cold War. It was binary. It was capitalism, it was communism. Right? It was this, it was that. It was very sort of two-dimensional, binary type of logic, and that's over. That ended, you know, if you want to take, you know, the bullshit liberal idea that the Cold War ended in 1989, that's when the digital age ended. We're very much returning to an analog era. Analog in the sense of analogy, in the sense of metaphor. The content might be digital. The content might be bits of ones and zeros. But the way it's organized is in an analogous structure, which I'm sort of leading up to and just giving you metaphors to really conceptualize how this exists. So what I try to do is I try to get out of this rearview mirror effect and say, okay, I don't want to sort of see what's happening in the past. I want to know what's happening now. I want to know how the state operates. I want to know how I can operate against the state. So I look at this guy, Harold Innes, who is a really good political economist based out of Toronto. Some people called him an anarchist. I'd say he's more of a social democrat. But generally a lefty who pioneered the study of communications. Explicitly, he wrote a book called Empire and Communications, in which he looked at the role of communications as founding the basis of empire throughout civilization. I mean, he started the dawn of civilization. He went through Assyria, Egypt, Babylon, all these different ancient civilizations, and showed how papyrus, paper, you know, stone tablets, how they influenced the nature of the state, and how the state was formed from this type of communication. And what he did in examining this was elucidate what he called the bias of communications. That each type of communications had a bias towards either space or a bias towards either time. And what consisted of an empire was the balance of these two spaces. Explicitly space, or rather the balance of these two biases. Explicitly space was the political administration. I.e. politics governed space. It governed borders, it governed the people within those borders, it governed the resources within those borders. And religion dealt with time. Religion was the governance of time. It dealt with belief systems, it dealt with birth, death, passage, all these different elements of our existence that deal with the passage of time, or continuance. Right? So you had, you know, in different empires, you know, politics would be more important, or religion would be more important, or they'd work together in sort of like a god king, or like as King Louis XIV, or in Egypt, in which the pharaoh was the god, and really it was the religion that ruled. But in every empire, you have both elements at the same time, mutually dependent. So I said, okay, let's cut to the chase. In today's day and age, what is the state? What is the politics? Right, so the first thing that jumped into my head, and literally this jumped into my head, wow, artificial intelligence. Neural networks and expert systems, which are metaphorically called the global market economy. Right, now a neural network, which is a type of artificial intelligence, what it does is it basically manages connections. So let's say you have 10,000 individuals who are brokers, managers, and owners. They sit at computer screens and they're all connected within this network, and they determine everything from foreign currency to stock ratings to, you know, national monetary policy. Right? And metaphorically, these humans as expert systems, because they're each experts trained in some field, are united through this neural network, and metaphorically they are artificial intelligence. Other people use terms like connected intelligence. But I like to use the word AI because then you can link it into a technological metaphor, so we start to see that maybe there isn't such a clear line between what is human and what is technology. Now, the religion side is virtual reality. Now, when I say virtual reality, really I'm using a metaphor to say consumerism, which is the ability, assuming you have the status and the money, to buy whatever reality you can construct. If you want to be Michael Jordan, you can buy his shoes, you can buy his clothes, you can have the music he listens to, you can reconstruct his identity. And again, this is very much based on hierarchy, status, and power. Right? Both within the AI of having access to different networks, and within the VR, of where you stand in the religious hierarchy. Right? Now this is the state's politics and the state's religion, and it's a globalized state. And it's not a Western state. It incorporates elements of Western civilization, but it incorporates elements of Eastern civilization. It incorporates elements of many types of civilization. It's Western appropriation gone mad. Now, one of the ways that I've been sort of describing this is sort of as the interplay of what's the commodification of identity and the identification of potential commodities. Sort of an inverted paradox, where everything, every type of identity, and this is identities of resources, of humans, of technology, of artifacts, is commodified, is put a value on. But this process is enacted not so much to actually commodify these identities, but to create a system in which any new possible commodity is identified. So anytime there's something new that you can sell, bam, it's there, value's put on it, and you can sell it really quickly. You know, capitalism gone wild. Now, another thing that Harold Innes talked about in terms of these biases was what he called monopolies of knowledge, you know, which we can colloquially just talk about monopoly. That what you find in all these different states is there's always some power elite who at some point uses force to establish a monopoly, to basically seize control. So the type of monopoly that is forming right now, that is the basis of all these mergers, and it's a global monopoly, is what I call a unified sensorium with ubiquitous centrality. Now, what this means, and I mean, I'm using all these different words, and I choose words very carefully, partly because I spend a lot of time reading and I spend a lot of time writing, but it's important for me to get this right, to not mix up these different words, right? And so what I mean by unified sensorium is I mean your entire experience. All of your communication, right? All of your community interaction, all of your national interaction, the way you live in society, right? It monopolizes all of it. You know, I mean, the most obvious is you can look how prevalent a role computers play in the organization of society. And the ubiquitous centrality means that it's centralized on a dramatic scale, but there is no center. I mean, it's centralized, but where's the center? Right, and this is, you know, it's difficult finding these power centers, and that's another contradiction which I won't expand on just yet. But basically what I'm describing is a system of holism and paradox. Everything exists, and it's all in contradiction. Right, it's a system in which everything is there, and you can see everything, but contradictions are so obvious. I mean, you sit here and you watch the news, and you know it's lies. And furthermore, you can set up your computer to get the real truth and telling you what's really happening. And they coexist. And they don't cancel each other out. It's not like matter and antimatter. No, it's like they're both there in your face. You know, and the example I usually give to non-radical audiences when I give this talk is I say, you know, the increasing income disparities between rich and poor. That's an obvious contradiction. Right? And it's increasing. You know, like, and liberals now, what they try to do is instead of saying rich and poor, they say information haves and information have nots. You know, which is this very sort of liberalized way to not look at poverty, right? And to not look at the nature of the capitalist system, but say everyone just needs a laptop and then everyone will be okay, right? Which, you know, is a crock. And what you're seeing now, and this was actually, I saw the Canadian Liberal Minister of Industry, even extrapolated this further, so it wasn't haves and have-nots, is what he called knows and no-nots, K-N-O-W. In the sense that there's those who know, and then there's those who just don't know. And this was their then conception of why people were rich and why people were poor, or why there was inequality. Which again is completely absurd and arguably morally offensive. Now, what's happening here, and this exists both on the state level and on the popular level, is that we're all running behind the rate of change. Change itself has just accelerated so quickly that everybody, even the state, is struggling to catch up. Now, the danger is the fact that the state has power. And when the state reacts to try to catch up, it has a lot more force to displace people to try to catch up. Right? To enact tyranny. To enact concentration. To enact, I mean, what I was calling here, elements of a private, unaccountable, anti-democratic authority that is not found within traditional institutions of the state, but is rather much more elusive. So we can't even really put our finger on it and, you know, point it out as a target for direct action or for civil disobedience. And so, I mean, this is being expressed, again, as what I call organized tyranny, which we all know under the names of IMF, World Bank, World Trade Organization, NAFTA. I mean, these are all puzzles of the same game, of the same apparatus, the same phenomenon. And it's only going to accelerate. I mean, we've heard about the MAI, the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, but again, these are all dress rehearsals, right? And, you know, this global economic state, because it's not a global political state, but the global economic state is all part of this reaction, this inability to keep up with change that the state then reacts to, that says, oh my God, we got to keep up, we're losing control, it's all chaos. Now, bringing it back to this whole idea of this governance of AI and VR. I mean, on the one hand, I could just call it the global market, and I could just say it's consumerism. But in defining what the market is, because then, you know, I had to ask myself, well, what is this market? You know, what is this thing that they talk about? I mean, is it, you know, like a bazaar in the middle of the city where you go to and you exchange goods? Not really. I mean, it's very much a mental construction. Because as, you know, I described it, let's say it was 10,000 individuals who were brokers, who were managers, who were owners. They're not sitting in the same room. I mean, they're not really in a boardroom. Maybe once a year, you know, some of the owners meet in a boardroom. But really, they're sitting at computer screens. You know, they're sitting at fluorescent screens which are projecting light onto their bodies. And what they do is they manipulate the light. So that the light sort of presents this image that they're comfortable in and allows them to manipulate reality, literally. And, you know, what they call it is market regulation. Right? This is the term that they refer to it as. Now, what is market regulation? It's the inevitable future predicted by pragmatism. Right? It's basically the return to the next quarter. And this is as far as it can go. It can't go past the next quarter. It can't tell you what the return's going to be 2 quarters from now. It'll just tell you what the returns of the next quarter are. And if those returns are wrong, the stock plummets. If they're right, the stock goes up. And this is how things are governed. Now, as a system, what we have is a self-aware, self-learning, self-healing, self-absorbed, self-destructive, complex neural network of expert systems comprised entirely of humans. Which is, you know, essentially what I'm trying to stress here. Because this phenomena that we call internet revolution, which I refuse to call internet revolution, but, you know, or what you can call convergence, or what you can call the media revolution, you know, a lot of people try to say that it's technology. That technology is changing society. Technology is changing the way we relate, and that is completely untrue. Humans are responsible. Humans invented the technology, humans are deploying the technology, humans are using the technology. Right? There are people responsible. You know, it's up to us to identify these people and target them. Unfortunately, increasingly, it's us, in part. I mean, not explicitly, because we can all identify, you know, our ruling class and capitalist class. But what the capitalist class has done and what it's doing with this internet revolution is expanding who the capitalist class is. Capitalism is, I wouldn't like to say perfecting, successfully developing class consciousness. And they're doing this with the stock market. So that most workers who have pension plans, their pension plans are now stocks, which makes them owners, which by definition they're the bourgeoisie. They have a stake in the system. Right? Managers now get stock options. Right? Basically, if you have any stake in the society, if you have an RSP, if you have a mutual fund, if you have any type of savings, those are now being converted directly into the stock market. So you are part of the capitalist class, literally, by definition. And this is their way of sort of protection. They're realizing, oh my God, everything's moving so quick. Let's expand our sense of self. But we'll do it in a very controlled way, right? In which, you know, on the one hand it's expanded, but on the other hand, control is drastically centralized. So the amount of capitalists who are on the top are actually decreasing, right? The amount of moguls who are on the top are actually decreasing. And so what we have is a ruling class cocooning themselves in a self-constructed virtual reality. Right? They live in a world which does not meet the physical conditions of our society. You know, which does not address poverty, which does not address hunger, which does not address environmental catastrophe, which quite frankly is what we're dealing with right now, let alone in the next 6 months, 12 months, and so on. You know, they can live separate of this. They can live above the earth, circulating around the earth, but not actually on it. Although they stop off every once in a while for big fat cat dinners, but basically their heads, and quite often their bodies, are not on the ground. Right? It's schizophrenic capitalism. It doesn't know its own sense of self, it has this falsely constructed self, and that happens to be the global market. Right? This artificial intelligence that is somewhat united in its organization of capital, that does exist around the world and uses virtual reality as the basis of its belief system, of the way it then constructs itself and holds itself. So, what do we do about it? How do we deal with these, pardon my French, fuckers, and how do we stop them now, before this insanity gets to a point where culturally it'll just be a bloodbath? And I don't think it'll be a bloodbath enacted by us. I think it'll be a bloodbath enacted by people like Pat Buchanan. You know, essentially reactionaries who, like us, are going, this globalization thing is whacked. You know, who are going, this rapid acceleration of change, that has nothing to do with us humans. We need to, you know, force, authority, bam, let's bring up God, let's bring up family. And this is what is you know, from my observation, is flourishing, of how people are reacting to this. So I say, all right, I got this artificial intelligence, this damn neural network, this mind, and then I got virtual reality, this sort of elusive, you know, melange of illusions, right? Society of the spectacle, simulation. What am I going to do about it? That's where I, you know, that's where this is where I observe and where I learn from social movements, hacking reality. Realizing that culture A exists everywhere, and you have to hack into that culture. I mean, you know, hacking reality has existed for all of time. You might, on one hand, you might call it activism, on another hand, you might call it social organizing, you might call it public education, you might call it just, you know, seeking the truth, finding out what's really happening. You know, it's conversation, it's dialogue, it's all these different elements, right? But what it ends up becoming is a bag of tricks or a set of tactics and strategy. It's the way we then deal with the state. And this is a state that exists at many different levels, right? So it ends up being expressed in many different ways. It ends up being, you know, civil disobedience, direct action, insurrectionary art, popular theater, culture jamming, Unix hacking, and explicitly network organizing. Realizing that there's all these different people who do different things in their own ways, and that's good. And there's no reason to ask people to do things differently because, you know, conditions are different in each community. But what we can do now is learn from these different struggles and begin not so much a top-down coordination, but a bottom-up facilitation. We're not even where we're facilitating other people, but other people are facilitating us, right? And, you know, the explicit example that happens with me is that right, or I pipe them into a web page. So I can get up in the morning and I flip open a little box in my email program and it has all the left-wing scholars who are looking at corporate concentration in media. And all their analysis is right there on my computer. Then I say, all right, that's interesting. Now I'd like to go look at Chiapas. And I've got all these email lists in Chiapas and I know everything that's going on in Chiapas that morning. And I say, okay, I'm, you know, today I'm interested in seeing what's going on in Toronto. Then I got a list of all the different groups that are going on in Toronto. And they're all here, you know, within this networked environment, right, of networking. It's not so much trying to control anything, it's just sitting back and letting things control themselves, right, and just sort of starting to understand that, and then I can do what's really important, which is human organizing, which is social work, which is social organizing, because that's, you know, quite frankly, I would like to control my community with my community. I would like to have popular rule in my city, where my city got to be able to define how my city was governed. You know, and that's a separate issue here than media and then internet. I mean, that's popular organizing, that's popular mobilization, that's something we can't forget. But what we find with all these different tactics in hacking reality is a different forum, a theater, if you will, and it's a global theater. Now, it's a ghettoized, commodified global theater. Was that your question?
I'm just telling you to do your anecdotes.
Yeah, I was, there's one, I'll open up, maybe there's other people in the room who can give like some of the anecdotes, but I'll come back to it. I mean, you know, it's a global theater that's commodified and ghettoized, meaning the state and power puts as much energy as they can to keeping you locked down in localized areas, so you don't actually have an impact. But the reality is, it's very easy to step up right center stage where the big light is and make a lot of noise, and that's what the Zapatistas have successfully demonstrated. But this global stage, anyone can walk onto. It takes different tactics to get onto the stage. You know, insurrection happens to be one of them. But it's possible, and it's a tactic that is necessary, right? And then what you get onto the stage, well, that's where alternative societies come from. That's where the concept of dual power comes in. That's where you start demonstrating that there are alternatives to this homogeny, to this hegemon that capitalism presents, and it's a global hegemon. I mean, you know, previously I said that it has nothing to do with Western society, you know, and it doesn't. I mean, it's, as I was saying, it's a mixture of all these different elements, and, you know, to simplify it in a sentence, it's Eastern form and Western content, right? Confucius organizes while Mickey Mouse distracts, right? It's a very authoritarian, consensus-based, sort of conglomerated tribal group model, you know, which you can find in various different forms throughout the world. And the content is the myth of the individual, is Mickey Mouse, you know, is the liberal individual, that we all have the freedom and the equal opportunity to be whatever we want, you know, which of course that is not at all the case. You know, your community is what determines your reality, and what we're finding is that communities can become networks. Now, you know, there's, as I said, old boys networks that ensure that the sons of these old boys go to the right schools, make the right connections, get the right jobs, and replace them in their positions of power. Right? And grassroots networks, you know, contrary, exist to mobilize communities, to get people out on issues, to get people out on actions, to agitate, to confront, right? To basically, it's this autonomous system of checks and balances. Now, what I've been describing in terms of this vision of AI and VR, in terms of this, what I call changing nature of the state, is exactly that. The state has changed, and no one is responsible for how it changed, but people are responsible for how it's changing, and people are trying to take control of that change. Because power is always obsessed with control, is always obsessed with maintaining control, and of course, you know, there's various elite factions who war for control. Now, you know, again, to summarize in a convenient sentence, the nature of this change, what's happened is we've gone from the flows of power, which, again, are embodied by the old boys' networks, to what are more accurately described as the power of flows. Now, the main difference between flows of power and power of flows has to do with that word power. That flows of power assumes that it's power that controls the system. Now, the other way, the power of flows, says it's the system that controls power. Now, who controls that system? People do. Now, what capitalism has realized is that they want those people to be part of their class. That those people possess a class consciousness, so they adhere to the interests of capital. But the reality is that it's still people. That forum, that 10,000 people who live in this meta-network of decision-making, that is the state, any one of us can get into that group of 10,000. We'll be isolated, we'll be commodified, we'll be ghettoized, and we'll be blocked off. But we have access to that. And again, the Zapatistas have demonstrated that they have access to it. I mean, there is absolutely no coincidence between the fact in 1994, when the Zapatistas staged their insurgency, the Mexican economy plummeted. It dropped. Because it was no longer the Mexican elite who were able to decide, this is how our economy is run. It was a global elite who said, oh my God, you've got an insurrection, we're pulling our money out. And the economy collapsed. And all of a sudden, the Zapatistas were participating at this level of decision making. Now, you know, they were met with huge responses, military, propaganda, you know, all these different levels. But they had an influence and continue to still have an influence, which is why we're here in this room. Right? And the influence they had was twofold. Capturing the curiosity and imagination of people. And I mean people in a very broad, general sense. But they also articulated the reality. What's happening right now, on local level and on a global level. And that was power. It was the power of identity. It was the power of communal identity. Right? Of what becomes identities of resistance that in meta networks become what's called a subject identity, which is no longer an identity that's resisting, but an identity that's building. An identity that says, you know, we have to resist, but we're stepping one step forward, we're building. We're creating a new society. Right? And that was articulation. That was expressing what's happening all over the world. You know, and like you were asking me to share a couple of anecdotes that we were talking about last night. One of them is this group based out of England called Reclaim the Streets, which is a very explicit class struggle on the ground anarchist organization that deals with mobilizing different constituencies to come out into the streets in support of things like the dock workers' strike in Liverpool. Right? Their next big action is going to be in Birmingham on May 8th against the G8 summit. Right? And they do all these different, I mean, they stem from the anti-road movement, they have a strong environmental background, but explicitly they're class struggle anarchists, and they feel, rightfully so, that the revolution is in the streets. And what you need to do is get people into the streets. And so this is another component, right? I mean, other examples of stuff that are going on, and I had a list here, are like the People's Global Action, which is in Europe, which is basically an anti-free trade movement. I mean, there's this big, you know, I like drawing this comparison of anti-free trade movements in Asia, North America, and Europe. In North America, the anti-free trade movements, we produce icons. You know, we produce Ralph Naders and Maud Barlows who speak for all of us, and on the ground, we do shit. You know, Buchanan does more against free trade than the left in general. In Europe, on the other hand, free trade movements are explicitly linked to anti-poverty organizations, to environmental organizations, to social justice, to trade unions, to organized labor. And it's broad-based coalition struggle that gets people onto the streets, that gets people to IMF meetings, that gets people to World Bank meetings, that gets people into physical direct action and confrontation with the state. Similarly, in Asia, anti-free trade movements produce general strikes. Massive, militant general strikes that shut down societies, that crash economies, right, that have visible financial damage on the state. You know, and so you look again, so People's Global Action is another example of the one that happens in Europe. You know, and there's various other types that I'm not going to go through, and, you know, there are people in the room, like, we were talking to Esther yesterday about this scam Dave was talking about that we did at Much Music. Which, you know, if he feels like it, or Amber's probably got a different perspective on the whole spectacle of how it's possible to walk into the mainstream media. That, like, with this, and here I'm sort of wrapping up the little rant. Well, yeah, it's not entirely true, but you can. Because what you find is that this system of governance, yes, it's governed by police, yes, it's governed by violence, yes, it's governed by physical obstruction, but essentially, like, and this is at a metaphorical level, but it's also at a very literal level, it's governed by cultural codes. Now, these cultural codes are racism, they're sexism, they're ageism, they're classism, but essentially they're cultural codes. And these cultural codes can be hacked, right? They can be manipulated. They can be socially reconfigured so you can obtain access to channels of power. When I say channels of power, I mean place where information flows. And you know, this is headline news. If you could get in, purely hypothetical, and this does not reflect any reality, if you could get in and program headline news for an hour, that's a lot of influence you can have. Amber, you want to go?
I was going to make a suggestion, since a lot of the words and the concepts you're using are far too academic, we need to understand. But I was thinking that it would be a wonderful thing to do is to have a discussion about how to even websites and internet, and something like that, in terms of organizing.
Yeah, I mean, I would. I mean, two things I'd like to respond to. First was the idea of academic language. That in fact, I don't consider that I'm using academic language. And if I was to use academic language to describe the phenomena that I've been describing, it would be a completely different discussion. And I mean, you know, you may have trouble with some of the words that I'm using. You'd have a lot more trouble if I was using academic language. An incredible amount of more trouble. And what I'm struggling to do is take the ideas that are in academia and bring it down to a very base level. And I'm using, in my mind, essentially rhetoric that stems from social movements. You know, although I still have to use some of these words like neural networks and expert systems, because I haven't figured out words to use it otherwise. Now, secondly, the first thing I said in my presentation was that my group is against the internet. And we're against computers. And I mean this very real. I use internet. I use email, I use web, but I only use it insofar as it gets me to people. If the internet cannot get me to people, I don't use it. I don't surf the web ever. Once in a while, I might get an email from Brian saying, hey man, go check out our website. And I will, because I know Brian physically, and he says, go check out my website. But usually the information on that website I've probably gotten from him orally already. Or if not orally, on a piece of paper, because I much prefer a piece of paper than reading a computer screen. But the aspect is, the internet is there. I mean, yeah, let me rephrase it. I fall into the corporate propaganda as easily as anyone else. Email is there. Email is a cheap, effective tool, and what you can do with an email list is take a room of people and keep them in a room. Voluntarily, they can leave, they can unsubscribe, and new people can come. And this allows a whole bunch of people to share an environment. right? One of the most successful examples of email lists, which was actually one of my first experiences of the internet, was this project called AInfos, where basically we took, you know, a large majority of the anarchists who were on the internet with existing anarchist publishing houses and existing anarchist publications, and we created a news service. We said, if you have a demo in your locality, or if you have an event, or if you have, you know, police repression, which was going on in Italy and in Greece and in the UK, send us news about it. We're interested. And furthermore, why don't you suggest direct action that we can follow up on? Right? And this has grown until, I mean, right now AInfos has about 2,000 subscribers who aren't entirely all anarchists, but, you know, border on, let's say, anarchist sympathizers. And it's created this awareness of anarchism around the world where, you know, me, this kid from Toronto, I know what's happening in Italy, even though I've never been to Italy. You know, and I'm aware of the situation in Italy, so when I go to Quebec and I see police repression against anarchists in Quebec, I draw this parallel with what's going on in Italy, and I say, hey, you know, we start talking about this, and we start contextualizing the struggle, and bam, right away, there is no doubt about it, this is a global struggle. So on the one hand, internet helps facilitate that, but, I mean, theoretically, the effect that the internet has is one of globalization. Right, Brian, jump in.
You, earlier, one of the things that you said that I totally grasped, I think, that well, you said that that technology is just, what was it, a tool, or what did you say about technology? That we, and it's unfortunate that now more and more, it's run by people, and that it's unfortunate that now more and more it's us, people that run it.
Well, that
we were using the technology, and I think that, well, there's two things that I find wrong with that. One is that it's not the people isn't the problem, it's not, the problem isn't that. When you said the problem isn't the technology, it's the people. I think that's not true. It's the institutions. And the other thing that I find wrong with it is that it's okay when it's at least positive or better when our institutions are using the technology that is otherwise only in the hands of hierarchical, you know.
But our institutions aren't using the technology. What's happening is that we're becoming part of their institutions.
What do you mean by that?
I'm trying and I'm organized with my locality, but unfortunately I do not operate a democratic telephone company. Until I do, and hopefully I will with the help of lots of different other people, we're participating in their institution. We are learning how to create our own, and we're squatting in their institution, but it's still in their institution. When we go on the internet, we are participating in a class that is not our own. When we are on the streets, we're participating in a class that is not theirs, that is ours. Unfortunately, at this time, the working class, the revolutionary class, the people, are not in control of the internet. It is not our institution. We're building our own institutions. They're separate from the internet. Right? Esther, you had your hand up.
Just, you know, practical use of web organizing. I just like to, you know, just to demonstrate how important the internet is. How many of us first learned about radical anything on the internet?
But that'll change.
Yeah, that will change. I mean,
I think the older rich people have access to computers and the older rich people.
No, but that's.
Nobody
that exists.
Yeah, like the pirates that have done these, everyone knows how to get on.
But what I. No, but the main point I was trying to say initially. No, but the thesis of my presentation was this is not about the internet. The internet is television. You all have televisions in your home. Right? The internet is your telephone. You do not control television.
Don't theorize this other.
That's not theory.
Talking about using computers.
No. We're talking about communicating with people over space and time. You can communicate over people's space and time with a telephone. You can communicate with people over space and time. Television's two-way.
How?
Television is not controlled. It's hierarchical and it's dominating, but they program television based on what they think and what they construct the audience wants to see.
How do I get back to television?
You are not who they're concerned about. The average consumer in suburbia is who they're interacting with, and it's that person's perspective that they put value on, and it's that person's perspective that is then programming the content on the TV.
It's the advertisers.
So that's not two-way for poor people.
It's not two-way for poor people. Poor people are marginalized and excluded from the system.
Systemically. Maybe you can focus discussion. talk to you, like, use a computer to, like, get away from the whole, like...
But I told you I can't do that because my collective is against computers. And so if you want me to, I mean, like, and I know you're getting frustrated because you want to hear about tactics using computers, and I'm saying, no, let's look at tactics using networks. Computers may play a role in networks, but I don't think we should rest on computers because they suck. And you know they suck. Come on.
My level of frustration is now because, even though I hate computers, and I don't like using them, I'm like, I have money, I think that a lot of people here kind of want to know how they can use, like, websites and email to contact each other, and to, and how they can use those resources to, like, get other people online. Maybe people aren't. The theory of, like, broad mass networking communication systems is
Are you asking, like, start the question, like, how do you get a free email account through a public operated website so you can...
I think, for me, a discussion of, like, how much energy should, like, this network, like, I mean, specifically the capacity organizing, how much energy should this network put into it?
Can I jump in for a second? Is there someone by the name of Emmett here?
Emmett?
Sorry.
Go ahead. I'm really interested in the discussion about this. I think it's really fascinating. I think it's something that we're talking about, a different approach to how we're thinking about these important.
I mean, just to directly respond to your concerns, I mean, another way I define the internet is as a black hole, something that sucks you in. And so the collective that I work with, what we try to work on is getting people offline, taking the information, like we're trying to get an office space right now, right? So we can have computer terminals where all the different anarchists who are in Toronto don't need to be online. You can come and meet us humans, and whatever information is online, we'll have offline. So we organize our effort to get people offline, because the largest corporations in the world, IBM, AT&T, Microsoft, are spending a lot of money to get people online. Hundreds of millions of billions of dollars. And so I'm saying, shit, I'm going to operate against them. I want to get people offline. I mean, I'm online, right? I got online. Like, it sort of happened by accident. And I used to spend, when I was, like, way back in the day, I was spending 15 hours a day online. I've now cut that down to 2. I hope to cut it down to 2 minutes. And then to 1 minute, and then be off. But there was, you had your hand up for a while.
I think you had an interesting presentation, and you touched on a lot of important things, but I'm not going to directly, because I think there are a lot of issues that you were taking up. I feel like it would be important also to deal with this very important question of on and offline. Some would argue, for example, I heard Harry Cleaver's paper, The Emergence of Work, a month ago or so, where he was arguing it's really important in a way to expand and bring people who are either in, for example, jobs. Let's say, for example, should we get money? Pull money together and be sure that every village and hamlet, each office, has an email terminal so that if anything happens, they can get right online and we'll learn about it right then. For example, that's one thing. Not everybody in that hamlet will have immediate access, but it would be like is that our ideal? Is it the ideal to, for example, make sure that we have a lot of people, say, coming from North America, who would be in every township? We can do both. Should we do both? Should we do one or the other? These are the kind of questions that, I would like to throw out.
Esther, you
want to
jump in?
Yeah, I
want to
respond to that. I think what he's talking about is communications, and internet communications is just one form of communications. And what he's presenting, in my opinion, is a much needed radical critique, analysis, tactical program for our use of communications. I think he should, and other people should, start giving some specific examples of how he personally and his collective has hacked. I would like to say that Amber's board is open to anybody who wants to come upstairs when the open workshop time is available, and we'll have an internet organizing workshop. And then your questions will be addressed.
Cool. I mean, I should, sorry, do you want to?
I have a question. I'm not convinced that technology is an evil thing.
Yeah, I mean, to jump on that and all screen what you're saying, I mean, I don't think that technology is separate from us. So I definitely don't think technology is evil. I'm not going to say technology is good. I think technology is integral to what is the human. Yeah, I mean, it's partly a tool. But it's all, I mean, what McLuhan talked about is an extension. You want to
tell us? Well, it's tool, like, you know, I saw a published magazine that can be used. I don't think you should criminalize it. I think it's who has control over it.
English is a tool.
Sure. Yeah, it's who has control over the technology, not the technology itself.
Right. So that's humans. Who has control? Now, before we go over there, because I want to just address that one question. I mean, again, I started off by saying that I actively disbelieve in the internet. But if you would prefer that I accept the internet and talk about the internet, then I will tell you I believe the internet has existed for thousands of years. And when I talk about the internet, I'm actually using a holistic term to describe all of communications. So when we talk about online or offline, everyone's online, assuming you're alive. Like, assuming you got electrons moving in your head, you're online. The difficulty is finding people online. Now the state, they're using computers to track people. So you can use computers to find people fairly conveniently. But there's other ways to find people too.
Yeah, just a comment on saying, like, whether it's just a, you know, not just a tool, but not all tools are the same. It is different, I think, to have a zine that you've published and to be investing in a multinational, you know, funded corporation, or we're funding it, but with the computers.
We have this, you know, this quote internet, right? Like, it speaks to globalization and capital. We want to live in that world. If we don't, we're going to change the way we think about policy and
globalization.
Well, you made a number of comments that probably you would say we're not conflicting, but
well,
when you spoke to the positive moment where you saw what was happening in Italy, and the way you were on the street in Toronto, you can recognize that what's happening on a global level. Well, that, you said, was based on your involvement with the internet.
No, with email.
With the email. Someone sends you a message, you know, that's for it. So,
no, email goes through the phone networks. Sorry, you guys say?
No, it's how the internet goes.
The internet, I again, should repeat, I don't believe the internet exists.
I can't send email unless I'm on.
No, you have to join a network. Like a private network like AOL, or a public network. So the local server, really, is just a phone company. I mean, what I'm doing is I'm squatting space within the phone company. But as I said, I was organized labor. So we're also trying to unionize the people who work in the phone company. I mean, not the people who are already unionized in the telecommunication workers unions, but the young hackers who work the internet switches, who work at the internet companies, and slowly squatting space within these electronic networks. Not internet. Because internet, that's, again, it's this broad-based word that's used for everything. But let's be explicit. Phone networks. They exist. We need them. They come in handy. I'm sure we'd all like to have free phone access. No.
Okay. But
yeah, go ahead.
You're using the term, and then you say you're totally against the internet.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy for me. The thing is,
that's where the confusion is, that I think that you recognize that there is a relationship that we can have to systems that are in operation, and we need to have the control of it. We need to know how to make it work for us, and we are finding ways to do that. And it is not to say that we have to work against being involved in these systems. We have to know how to define our involvement and make it effective. And I think that's what you said it is when you're getting information whether it's email or in what form. I mean, most of mine is email also. But when I want to read La Granada, believe me, I hope you and I read La Granada.
I mean,
okay, so that's the system I put in my service.
I should make, I mean, two clarifications. One, I don't actually get information. I get intelligence, which is better than information, because it's information that's been contextualized, right, and that connects with other different things, which is hypertext in different ways. But the other thing is, I mean, if you want me to be explicit, I think we should take over the phone networks. If we take over the phone networks, this includes the basis of global capitalist production, the stock markets themselves, right? What's that? No, the phone network, yeah, don't get me wrong, the phone network is a computer. The phone network itself is a large computer, and I think that we should take it over.
Domestic, get a computer to get into the mail.
No, I think that, I think that we should mobilize people into the street, go to the buildings in every city that physically houses computers and physically take them over.
Like Madrid.
Exercise the means, exercise control over the means of production. I'm not saying that we should build our own phone networks, I'm saying we should take theirs. Yeah. Turn their markets off. Yeah, I mean, to do that, we have to, like, this is why I learned about computers. And again, we can talk about computers. Like, there's a difference I'm making between telephone networks, electronic mail computers, and internet. Internet is, and what happens, I mean, not just here in, you know, quote-unquote, a radical setting. In any setting, I fall into the same corporate propaganda. It's so immersive. And it's so penetrating, it's easy to just talk about the internet. And I do all the time. And I have to stop and question myself and say, kid, what are you talking about?
I guess my thing, because I agree with a lot of what you're saying, like, and I think basically what your main conclusion is that the power comes from the street, and how do we get it on the street? I guess the thing is that one thing I want to address is in terms of networks and privilege within the movement itself. Because I think, like, and I guess this is coming back to sort of the Much Music stuff, because I think what you folks did in Much Music was a brilliant, brilliant action in terms of hacking reality, but it was also because you had a privilege within the movement that got you into Much Music, and I think we have to recognize that privilege within our own movements, and also recognize how do we break that down, because I think that's important, and recognize that not always what we have as our reality through our privilege, wherever we are, is necessarily the reality somewhere else. So like when you're talking about putting computers into Chiapas, like in communities where people are starving and need medicine and arms, you know, that may seem like a really good thing to us where we are now. And I don't know, because I'm not in Chiapas, maybe it is a good thing there. But, you know, I think we have to recognize that power. I don't know what I'm saying, but I think, you know, that's kind of what I'm saying.
Right on. Yeah, similar to what he was saying, and to address some of what you were trying to bring up, and I don't know if this addresses it completely, but some of these issues came up at a Detroit InfoShop gathering we had a few years ago, and that there was a danger in a hierarchy coming out of our movement of and people who have access to computers and internet and email. Then running, say, a solidarity network, mm-hmm. and excluding and marginalizing people who don't have access to those types of things. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we talked about was ways to make, within our own circles, for example, using Blackout Books in New York, we tried to put a computer out there so that any activist, and I lived in a squat for many years without a phone, without a computer, things like that, so the internet was always a very offensive thing to me, and when people were talking about organizing in that way, I was always offended. Mm-hmm. And with Blackout Books or ABC Now Radio, having a computer,
this concludes the session. What this was an event at in Syracuse, New York, over the weekend of April 18th and 19th. The event was organized by the Media Action Coalition in Syracuse, New York.